The construct charged forward like a battering ram, and she leapt out the way and left half the skin of one knee on the ground for her pains. She still had a mouthful of blood as she began to holler, "Ha! Nearly!" crackled the speaker. "Ro! Just let me take a whack at it!" "Not yet! Nearly! The bitten tongue was good! Hold it off for a second, Nev! You could do this asleep!" Not with a rapier. She might as well have chucked both knuckle and sword to the ground and started jogging for all the good her weapons were doing. Gideon wasn't equipped for defence, and her head hurt. Her focus kept twitching in a migraine blur, dots and sparks coruscating in and out of her vision. A titanic blow from the construct bent her parry almost all the way back around to her head, and she moved with the blow rather than against as more of an afterthought. 3 seconds! 2! It almost sounded like begging. Gideon was feeling more and more nauseous. There was an oily, warm feeling in the back of her throat, and her tongue was running wet with spit. When she looked at the construct now, it was through a hazy overlay, as though she were seeing double. There was a sharp pain between her eyes as it hauled back its center of gravity, lurched. "I can see it!" Later on, Gideon would think about how little triumph there was in Hero's voice, more awe. Her vision blurred, then spiked back abruptly into 20/20 colour. Everything was brighter and crisper and cleaner, the lights harder, the shadows colder. When she looked at the construct, it smoked in the air like hot metal. Pale, nearly transparent coronas wreathed its malformed body. They simmered in different colours, visible if you squinted this way or that, and in admiring them, Gideon nearly got her leg broken. "Nav!" hollered the speakers. Gideon took a hard dive out of the way of a low stab and then rolled away as the construct followed up by stomping hard where her foot had been. She hollered back, "Tell me what to do!" "Hit these in order. Left lateral radius." Gideon focused on the nubbly, too-thick joint of the high left arm and was surprised to find one of those mirage-like lights there. She sliced down and felt nearly off balance as her blade went through like a hot knife through fat. The long blade of the mutant arm clattered to the floor forlornly. "Bottom right tibia, lower quadrant, near the notch," said Harrow. Now her triumph was barely held at bay. "Don't make any other hits!" Easier said than done. Gideon had to play grab-ass, snaking out of the construct's remaining blades before she disdained the rapier and slammed her booted foot down instead. It wasn't hard. That part, just like the radius, was glowing like a flare. She got a square hit in, and the construct's leg shattered. It rocked to the side, trying to compensate, and the leg did not start regenerating. The next was easy, side of the mandible. The 18th rib. She peeled the construct apart, removing the unseen strut mechanisms that turned it from monster into pathetic, jaw-clattering fuck-up, some kid's first attempt at bone magic without ever having taken a look at an anatomy chart. When at last the Reverend Daughter said, "Sternum!" Gideon was already there, raising one gauntleted fist up where a slice of sternum glowed like a candle flame and punching it into dust. The construct collapsed. Gideon felt dizzy for just a second, and then it left her. The whole world brightened and sharpened. The only thing left of the monster was a big chunk of pelvis, atomizing slowly into sand. There was a pleasing overhead beep, and the door to response whooshed open, and remained open, letting through a Harrow so wet with sweat that her hood was stuck to her forehead. Gideon was distracted by the pelvis as the sand crumbled and parted to reveal a gleaming black box. Its lead-coloured screen ticked up 15%, 26%, 80%, until it swung open with a soft click to reveal nothing more interesting than a key. Harrow uttered a soft cry and swooped, but Gideon was quicker. She took it up and unsnapped the keyring she now kept down her shirt, and she looped it through one of the ornate clover-shaped holes on the handle. Two keys now dangled there in triumph, the upper hatch key and their new prize. They both admired them for a long moment. The new key was chunky and solid and dyed a deep, juicy scarlet. Gideon found herself saying, "I saw lights when I was fighting it. Overlay. Bright spots where you told me to hit. A glowing halo. Is that what you meant by thanagetic signature?" She expected some dismissive, "You could not have comprehended the dark mysteries only my mascarad eye doth espy," and was not prepared for Harrow's open astonishment. Beneath the thick rivulets of blood and the smeared paint, she looked completely taken aback. "Do you mean," her adept said slowly, "that there were things in the skeleton framework? Mechanical lights, perhaps? Diode segments?" "No, they were just googly areas of light. I couldn't really see them properly," she said. "I only saw them toward the end, when you were messing around." "That's not possible. I'm not lying." "No, I'm just saying, that shouldn't have been possible," Harrow said. Her dark brows were furrowed so deeply that they looked like they were on a collision course. "I thought I knew what the experiment was doing, but, well, I cannot assume." Gideon, tucking the keys safely back into her bandeau and wincing at the chill, readied a flip comment. But as she looked up, Harrowhark was looking at her, dead in the eye. Her chin was set. Harrow always looked so aggressively. Her face was moist from the effort, and there were starbursts of broken red capillaries tucked into the white of each eye. But she turned those pitch-black irises right on her cavalier. The expression on her face was completely alien. Harrowhark, Nona Jessimus, was looking at her with unalloyed admiration. "But for the love of the Emperor, Griddle," she said gruffly, "you are something else with that sword." The blood all drained away from Gideon's cheeks for some reason. The world spun off its axis. Bright spots sparked in her vision. She found herself saying intelligently, "I was in the privileged position of feeling you fight," Harrow continued, fingers nervously flexing, "and it took me a while to work out what you were doing, longer still to appreciate it. But I don't think I'd ever really watched you, not in context. Well, all I can say is thank the tomb that nobody knows you're not really one of ours. If I didn't know that, I'd be saying that you were Matthias Nonius come again, or something equally saccharine." "Harrow," said Gideon, finding her tongue, "don't say these things to me. I still have a million reasons to be mad at you. It's hard to do that and worry that you got brain injured." "I'm merely saying you're an incredible swordswoman," said the necromancer briskly. "You're still a dreadful human being." "Okay, cool, thanks," said Gideon. "Damage done, though. What now?" Harrowhark smiled. This smile was unusual, too. It betokened conspiracy, which was normal, except that this one invited Gideon to be part of it. Her eyes glowed like coals with sheer collusion. Gideon didn't know if she could handle all these new expressions on Harrow. She needed a lie down. "We have a key, Griddle," she said exultantly. "Now for the door." Gideon was thinking about nothing in particular when they left number 1-2, transference, winnowing, data center, except that she was happy, buzzed with adrenaline and anticipation. She'd eaten a good meal. She'd won the game. The world seemed less maliciously unfriendly. She and Harrow left in companionable silence, both swaggering a little, though newly conscious of the cold and the dark. They hurried along the corridors, Harrowhark leading, Gideon following half a step behind. There was nobody but them to trigger the motion sensors, and the lamps popped to life in rhythmic whoomk, whoomk, Onk. They lit the way through the central room with the bronchial passages, and then down the short corridor to the access hatch ladder. At the beginning of that hall, Harrow Harks stopped so abruptly that Gideon bumped into her in a flurry of robes and sword. She had gone absolutely still, and did not push back against her cavalier's stumble. For the first moment, following Harrow's line of sight to the foot of the ladder, Gideon disbelieved her eyes. Her brain in an instant supplied all the information that her guts didn't want to conceive, and then it was her, stuck, frozen, as Harrow sprinted to kneel alongside the tangle of wet laundry at the bottom of the ladder. It wasn't wet laundry. It was two people, so gruesomely entangled in each other's broken limbs that they looked like they had died embracing. They hadn't, of course. It was just the way their back-to-front limbs had arranged themselves in untidy death. Hot bile rose in her mouth and made her tongue sticky. Her gaze drew away from the blood and exposed bone and fixed inanely on the empty wet scabbard by one busted wet hip. Nearby was the sword, fallen point down in the flooring grill. The green lighting underfoot made its ivory steel glow a sickly lime. Gideon's necromancer stonily flopped the top corpse to the side, exposing what remained of both faces, before rising to stand. She'd known before Harrow had rolled him over that before them lay the sad, crumpled corpse of Magnus Quinn, jumbled up with the sad, crumpled corpse of Abigail Pent. Act 3. Chapter 17. In the early morning, after hours and hours of trying, even Palamedes admitted defeat. He didn't say so in as many words, but eventually his hand stilled on the fat marker pen that he had used to draw 20 different overlapping diagrams around the bodies of the fifth, and he didn't try to call them back any more. Six necromancers had tried to raise them, singly or in concert, simultaneously or sequentially. Gideon had squatted in a corner and watched the parade. In the beginning, a group of them had opened their own veins in a bid to tempt the early hunger of the ghosts. That period ended only when the teens, mad with rage at the inadequacy of only Isaac's blood, both started stabbing at Jean-Marie's arm. They stood screaming at each other wordlessly, corseting belts above each other's elbows to make the veins stand out, until Camilla took the knives from their hands and began dispensing rubber bandages. Then they held each other, knelt, and wept. Harrow did not open herself up. She walked the perimeter like a wraith, measuring her steps for Palamedes to draw by, swaying minutely with what Gideon knew was exhaustion. Nor did Coronabeth spill her blood. She only drew close to the work to pull Ianthe's hair away from her face, or to take a tiny knife from the twins' bags to replace the one her sister was using. They had both come from their beds without bothering to dress, and hence were wearing astonishingly flimsy nightgowns, the only solace of the night. The air was full of chalk and ink and blood and strong light from the electric torches that the sixth had rigged up. The sixth had been painfully useful. Palamedes, wearing a scruffy bedrobe, had put up lights and marked the ladder with bits of tape at obscure places. He had stained the fluff on his dowdy old slippers pink as he walked quietly among the bodies, saying, "Excuse me," once when he stepped too close to Abigail's arm. He held the light up for Camilla as she sketched the whole unlovely scene on a big sheet of white flimsy, from the side, from the top, from their feet. He shed his scruffy bedrobe to reveal button-up pajamas when Dulcinea drifted in wearing only a short shirt and trousers too big for her, and wrapped the robe around her shoulders without prompting. Then he went back to work. A tableau of magicians and their guardians revolved around the corpses. Books were hauled out of pockets or the insides of coats, read, abandoned. People would go in, work, leave, be replaced, return, stay, leave as more of the inhabitants of Canaan House arrived. Harrowhark worked for nearly 2 hours before fainting abruptly into a puddle of congealing blood, at which point Gideon had removed her from the scene. Upon waking, she shadowed the sixth instead, much to the ill-concealed annoyance of Camilla, who seemed to regard all incursions on Palamedes' personal space as probable assassination attempts. For his part, Palamedes talked quietly and briskly to Harrow, as though to a colleague he had known all his life. The third princesses worked like musicians who couldn't help but return for the encore. A spell. Retirement. Another. Another. They knelt side by side, holding hands, and for all that Ianthe had made fun of her sister's intellect, Corona never broke a sweat. It was Ianthe who ran wet with blood and perspiration. At one point she beckoned Nibirius forward and, in a feat that nearly brought up Gideon's dinner, again, ate him. She bit off a hunk of his hair, she chewed off a nail, she brought her incisors down on the heel of his hand. He submitted to all this without noise. Then she lowered her head and got back to work, sparks skittering off her hands like fire off a newly beaten sword, every so often spitting out a stray hair. Gideon had to stare pretty hard at skimpy nighties to get over that one. The horrid Isaac worked, but Gideon didn't like to look at him. He was sobbing with his entire sad teen face, mouth, eyes, nose. Dulcinea reached out as though to join the fray, until Protesilaus drew her back with a hand as inexorable as it was meaty. The revolving parade of necromancer after necromancer went on, until just Palamedes was left. Then he slumped as though his strings had been cut, blindly reaching for the bottle of water Camilla held out, pulling long gasps of liquid.
"Coming down," said a voice from the top of the ladder.
Down the ladder came the jaundiced, faded cavalier of the Eighth House, dressed in his leathers, with his sword at his hip. He helped his uncle, who was white and silver and alight with distaste, to the bottom. The Eighth Adept primly rolled up his alabaster sleeves and skirted the corpses, considering, licking two fingers as though to turn a page.
"I will try to find them,"
he said in his strangely deep and sorrowful voice. Harrow said, "Don't waste your time, Octor Kizaron. They're gone." The eighth necromancer inclined his head. The hair that fell over his shoulders was the funny ashy white you got when a fire burned away. A headband kept it scraped back and away from his sharp and spiritual face.
"You will pardon me," he said, "if I do not take advice on spirits from a bone magician."
Harrow's face slammed shut. "I pardon you," she said.
"Good. Now we need not speak again," said the eighth necromancer. "Brother Colum?"
"Ready, Brother Silas," said the scarred nephew immediately, and stepped in closer to the younger man so that they were near enough to touch.
For a moment, Gideon thought they were going to pray in front of the corpses, or they might share an emotional moment. They were close enough to hug it out. But they did neither. The necromancer laid his hand on one of Colum's brawny shoulders, having to stretch up somewhat, and closed his eyes. For a moment, nothing seemed to happen. Then Gideon saw the colour begin draining from Colum the Eighth, as though he were covered with cheap dye, leeching a shadow-leached hue in the night-time, more horrible and more obvious in the unforgiving light of the electric torches and underfloor lamps. As he faded, the pale Silas incandesced. He glowed with an irradiated shimmer, iridescent white, and the air began to taste of lightning. Someone close by said softly, "So it's real." Just as someone else said, "What is he doing?" It was Harrow who said, without rancor, but also without joy, "Silas Octor Kizaron is a soul siphoner." By this point, Colum the Eighth looked grayscale. He was still standing, but he was breathing more shallowly. By contrast, the Adept of the Eighth was putting on a light show, but not much else happened. The furrow deepened in the ghostly boy's brow. He wrung his hands together, and his lips soundlessly began to move. Gideon felt an internal tug, like a blanket being pulled off in the cold. It was a little bit like the sensation back in response, which was, what, 1,000 years ago? Something deep inside her being prodded in its tender spot. But it also wasn't, because it hurt like hell. It was like having a headache inside her teeth. The torchlights gave an asthmatic gurk and dimmed as though their batteries were being sucked dry. And when Gideon looked at her hands through bleary eyes, they were deepening grey. There was something pale blue sparking within the corpse of Abigail Pent, and suddenly and horribly the body shuddered. The world grew heavy and black around the edges, and Gideon felt cold all the way to her marrow. Someone screamed, and she recognized the voice as Dulcinea's. Abigail's body shivered once. It shivered again. Silas opened his mouth and let out a guttural sound like a man who had eaten hot iron. One of the torches exploded, and out of the corners of her eyes, Gideon saw him stretch out his arms. Gideon moved thickly through the grey-lipped crowd, watching Dulcinea collapse in what felt like slow motion, reaching out to the rumpled figure in the big dressing gown. Gideon slung Dulcinea's arm over her shoulder and pulled her limp body upright, teeth chattering so hard she was worried about biting the insides of her cheeks. Protesilaus stalked forward, and he did not even bother to draw his sword. He simply punched Silas in the face. Dulcinea wailed out from Gideon's arms, weak and shrill. "Pro!" But it was too late. The 8th necromancer went down like a sack of dropped potatoes and twitched on the floor. Now Protesilaus drew his rapier with an oily click of metal on scabbard. The lights crackled, then blazed back to life. The cold receded as though someone had closed a door against a howling wind. Strangely enough, Column the 8th did not even react. He just waited greyly next to Protesilaus like concrete, as Protesilaus stood over Column's flawed uncle, sword held at the ready. They both looked like crude sculptures of men.
"Children!" cried a voice high from the hatch. "Children, stop!"
It was Teacher. He had descended the first few staples of the ladder, but this was all he could apparently bear. For the first time since Gideon had met him, he seemed real and old and frail. The serene and, frankly, impenetrable good cheer had been replaced by wild terror. His eyes were bulging, and he was huddled against the top of the ladder like it was a life raft.
"You mustn't," he said. "He cannot empty anybody here, lest they become a nest for something else. Bring Abigail and Magnus the 5th upstairs. Do it quickly."
Palamedes said, "Teacher, we should leave the bodies where they are if we want to know anything about what happened."
"I dare not," he called back, "and I daren't come down there to remove them. You must bring them up. Use stretchers or magic. Reverend Daughter, use skeletons, use anything, but you must get them out of there immediately and come up with them."
Maybe they were all still slothful from what had just gone on. Maybe it was just the fact that it was the very small hours of the morning and they were all very tired. The numb hesitation was palpable. It was a surprise when Camilla raised her voice to say,
"Teacher, this is an active investigation. We're safe down here."
"You are absolutely wrong," said Teacher. "Poor Abigail and Magnus are dead already. I cannot guarantee the safety of any of you who remain down there another minute."
Chapter 18. Bring them up was easier said than done. It took nearly an hour to remove the bodies and to store them safely. There was a freezer room, and Palamedes reluctantly allowed them to be interred there, and to get the houses up and crowded into the dining hall. Herohark's skeletons could climb a ladder, even bearing wrapped corpses, but Column the 8th did not respond to pleas, threats, or physical stimulus. He was slightly less grey than previous, but he had to be hauled up bodily by Corona and Gideon. The moment he saw Column, teacher cried out in horror. Getting him up had been the hardest part. He now rested at the end of the table with a bowl of unidentifiable herbs burning under his chin, the smoke curling around his face and eyelashes. Currently, everyone not stretched out on the floor of the dining room, lying in state in the freezer room, or huffing herbs, were sitting around miserably clutching cups of tea. It was weirdly like their first day in Kanan House, in both suspicion and dullness, just with a bigger body count. The only ones who seemed even vaguely compos mentis were the second house. As it turned out, they had been the ones to call teacher to the access hatch, and now they sat ramrod straight and resplendent in their second-styled cohort uniforms, all scarlet and white. They both affected the same tightly braided hairstyle and abundance of gilt braid, and also the same serious business expression. They were only distinct because one wore a rapier and the other quite a lot of pips at her collar. Teacher sat a little way away from them, his naked fear replaced by a deep and weary sadness. He sat close to the wheezy little heater, taking off the morning chill, and the other two Kanan House priests shrouded themselves in their robes and refilled everybody's cups. The necromancer of the second house cleared her throat.
"Teacher," she said, in a cultured and resonant voice, "I would like to repeat that the best course of action is to inform the cohort and bring military enforcers."
"I will repeat, Captain Deuteros," he said sadly, "that we cannot. It is the sacred rule."
"You must understand that this is non-negotiable. The fifth house must be informed. They, of all houses, would want an investigation carried out immediately."
"A murder investigation," added Jean-Marie, who had not touched her tea.
"Murder," said teacher. "Oh, murder. We cannot assume that it was murder."
Whispers began to cross the room. The second cavalier said rather more heatedly,
"Are you suggesting that it was an accident?"
"I would be very surprised if it were, Lieutenant Dias," said teacher. "Not Magnus and Lady Abigail, a seasoned necromancer and her cavalier, and sensible adults in their own right. I do not think it was an unhappy misadventure. I think they were killed."
"Then
murder is done by the living," said teacher. "They were found entering the facility. I cannot begin to explain how grave a threat that is to anyone's safety. I will not bother trying to keep it secret now. I told each of you who asked my permission to enter that place that it would mean your death. I did not say that figuratively. I told all of you that you were walking into the most dangerous place in the system of Dominicus, and I meant it. There are monsters here."
Nibiria said, "So why aren't they coming for you? You've lived here years."
Teacher said, "Years and years and years. They are not coming for the guardians of Kanan House yet, but I live in fear of the day they do. I believe Abigail and Magnus have run tragically afoul of them. I cannot countenance the idea that whatever grief they came to was orchestrated by someone in this room."
Silence rippled outward to the four corners of the dining hall.
Captain Deuteros broke it by saying repressively, "This is still a case for the proper authorities."
Teacher said, "I cannot and will not call them. Lines of communication off-planet are forbidden here. For pity's sake, Captain Deuteros, where is the motive? Who would harm the fifth house? A good man and a good woman."
The necromancer steepled her gloved fingers together and leaned forward.
"I cannot speculate about motive or intent," she said. "I hardly want it to be murder, but if you don't comply with me, I have reasonable grounds to stop this trial. I will take command if you cannot."
Someone thumped their tea mug down on the table hard. It was Corona Beth, who, even with her violet eyes full of sleep and her hair in burnished tangles around her face, would still have caused tourist traffic to wherever she was standing. "Don't be silly, Judith," she said impatiently. "You don't have that kind of authority."
"Where no authority exists to ensure the safety of a house, the cohort is authorized to take command."
"In a combat zone."
"The Fifth are dead. I take authority for the Fifth. I say we need military intervention, and we need it right now. As the highest-ranked cohort officer present, that decision falls to me." "A cohort captain," said Nibirius, "don't rank higher than a third official." "I'm very much afraid that it does turn."
"Prince Turn, if you please," said Ianthe. "Judith," said Corona, more coaxingly before an inter-household war kicked off. "This is us. You've come to all our birthday parties. Teacher's right. Who would have killed Magnus and Abigail? Neither of them would have ever hurt a fly. Isn't it possible that the hatch was left up and something happened? And it's such a long fall. Who was in there? Ninth, wasn't it you?" With marked frostiness, Harrow said, "We locked the hatch before continuing in." "You're sure?" Gideon, who had been the one to turn the key, was oddly grateful that Harrowhark did not even bother looking in her direction. She simply said, "I am certain." "How many people had these hatch keys other than the Ninth?" said Corona. "We had no idea the basement was even there."
"The Sixth," said Camilla, "and Palamedes as one."
Dulcinea said, small and tired, "Pro and I have one," which made Gideon's eyebrows raise right to her hairline.
"Colum has the copy given to the Eighth House," said a voice from the floor.
It was Silas. He had sat up and was now mopping his face with a very white piece of cambric. His eye was red and shiny and swollen, and he dabbed carefully around it. Corona gallantly offered him her arm, but he refused, pulling himself to stand heavily against a chair.
"He has the key," he said, "and I told Lady Pent of the existence of a facility beneath this floor after the party."
It was Harrow who said, "Why?"
"Because she asked," he said, "and because I do not lie, and because I'm not interested in the Ninth House ascending to Lictorhood alone, simply because they guessed a childish riddle."
Harrowhark closed herself up like a folding chair, and her voice was like cinders.
"Your hatred of us is superstition, Octokizaron."
"Is it?"
He folded the dirty handkerchief neatly and tucked it inside his chainmail.
"Who was in the facility when Lady Pent and Sir Magnus died? Who was conveniently first on the scene to discover them?"
"You have one black eye already, courtesy of the Seventh House," said Harrow, "and you seem to yearn for symmetry."
"That was the Seventh, then?"
The Eighth Necromancer did not seem particularly displeased.
"I see. It happened so swiftly I wasn't sure."
Gideon had thought Dulcinea asleep again. She was so limp and prone in Protesilaus's arms. But she opened her big blue eyes and struggled to raise her head.
"Master Silas," she said thickly, "the Seventh House begs forgiveness of the merciful Eighth. Please grant it. This would be such an embarrassment to the House. Pro reacts quicker than I do. You wouldn't duel me, would you?"
"Never," said Silas gently. "That would be heartless. Colum will face the Cavalier of the Seventh."
Gideon felt her fingers clench into fists as Dulcinea took a deep, wobbly breath and said quietly,
"Oh, but please."
"Stop this now," said Corona Beth. "This is madness." The laughing golden butterfly was gone. She stood now, hands on her hips, chilly amber. Her voice rang out like a trumpet. "We must make a pact," she said. "We can't leave this room suspecting one another. We're meant to be working for a higher power. We knew it was dangerous. We agreed. And I can't believe that any of us here would have meant harm to Magnus and Abigail. We need to trust one another, or this'll devolve into madness."
The captain of the second rose, too.
Her intensely dark eyes settled on each of them in turn, before ending on Teacher.
"Then what must we logically assume?" she said. "That, as Teacher has said, there is a malevolent or obstructive force within the first house? Vengeful ghosts or monsters born of some necromantic act?"
The awful necromantic teen rose to stand now. His eyes were raw and red, and his fists were dirty with blood. The numb agony on his face was like an animal in pain. When he spoke, one expected only tortured baying. But he said,
"If there is a monster, it's got to be hunted. If there's a haunting, it's got to be banished. Whatever was strong enough to kill Abigail and Magnus, it can't be left alone."
Then, more wildly,
"I can't go home until whatever killed Abigail and Magnus is dead."
Jean-Marie said instantly,
"I'm with Isaac. I say we hunt it."
"No," said Palamedes.
He had taken off his glasses to polish them, huffing once on one lens, then on the other. Everyone's eyes were on him by the time he put his spectacles back on his beaky nose. Camilla perched on the table behind him like a grey-coated crow, haunting his shoulder.
"No," he repeated. "We'll proceed scientifically. Nothing can be assumed until we have a better sense of how they both died. With everyone's permission, I'll examine the bodies. Anyone who wants to join me can do so. Once we ascertain the facts, we may plan a course of action. But until then, no conclusions. No monsters, no murder, no accidents."
Coronabeth said warmly, "Hear, hear."
"Obliged, Princess. We now all know about the existence of the facility," he continued. "I imagine this will lead to it being explored freely. We should all keep an eye out for unusual danger, and agree that information is the best gift we can give one another."
Harrowhark said, "I have no intention of collaborating."
"You won't be forced to, Reverend Daughter. But it's not orthogonal to the Lictor experiment to warn your colleagues if you think there's something out of place," said Palamedes, leaning his chair back. "Exempli Gratia, a horde of vengeful ghosts."
"There is one final matter of keys," said Teacher.
Everyone, now probably getting neck strain, looked back to him. They waited for a punchline, but there was none. Then they followed his line of sight. He was looking straight at Princess Ianthe in her clinging nightgown, pallid hair falling in two smooth braids down to bloodless shoulders, staring back with eyes like violets on dialysis.
"I am also in possession of one," she said, unruffled.
"What?"
She did not lose composure.
"Don't act a jilted lover, Babs."
"You never said a damned word."
"You didn't keep your eyes on your keyring."
"Ianthe Tridentarius," said her cavalier. "You are... you're... Corona, why didn't you tell me?"
Corona stopped him, one slender hand on his shoulder. She was looking at her twin, who calmly avoided her gaze.
"Because I didn't know," she said lightly, chair scraping as she rose to stand. "I didn't know either, Babs. I'm going to bed now, I think. I'm somewhat overwrought."
Courteously, Palamedes stood too.
"Cam and I want to look at the bodies," he said. "If Captain Deuteros and Lieutenant Dias would like to accompany us, as I assume you're going to." "Yes," said Judith. "I'd like a closer look."
"Cam, you go on ahead," Palamedes said. "I want a quick word."
The scene broke up after that. The salt and pepper priest was talking to Isaac very quietly, and Isaac's shoulders were shaking as he tucked himself into his seat. The third left with dislocated proximity and the clenched jaws of three people on their way to have an enormous tiff. Dulcinea was whispering quietly to her cavalier, and they surprised Gideon by following the mob to the freezer. Maybe not that surprising. Dulcinea Septimus could outmorbid the ninth. The word Palamedes wanted turned out to be with Harrow. He plucked her sleeve and beckoned her off to the corner of the room, and she went without a cavil. Gideon was left alone, watching Teacher join the whey-faced Silas as he knelt before his cavalier. His lips moved in silent prayer. Colum was now greyish all over, and his eyes had the thousand-yard stare of a man in a stupor. Silas did not appear to be worried. He had clasped one of those big, hard-bitten hands between his own and murmured to him, and Gideon caught some of the words.
"I bid you return."
Teacher was saying,
"He'll have a hard fight to come back, Master Octokizeron, harder than he may have anticipated. Is he used to the journey?"
"Brother Colum has fought harder and in colder climes," said Silas calmly. "He has come back to me through stranger ghosts. He has never once let his body become corrupted, and he never shall."
Then he went back to the mantra.
"I bid, I bid."
For some reason, that image stayed with her. The mayonnaise magician and his thick-set nephew, older than him by far, staring out of empty eyes as Teacher watched with the air of a man with front-row seats to back-alley dental surgery. Gideon watched too, fascinated by an act she couldn't understand, when a hand closed around her wrist. It was Jean-Marie Chatour, her eyes red-rimmed, sticky and stained, her hair in a frizz. There was no sign of pluck in her now, except maybe a wild hardness around the eyes as she looked at Gideon.
"Knight," she said hoarsely, "if you know anything, tell me now. If you know anything, I've got to... They meant too much to us, so if you know..."
Gideon felt very sad. She put her hand on the bad teen's shoulder, and Jean-Marie flinched away. She shook her head no. And when Jean-Marie's big eyes, lashes clumped with last night's makeup, irises an inky brown, filled with tears, she tried to furiously blink away, Gideon stopped being able to even slightly deal. She put her hand on top of the other cavalier's head, which was damp and curly like a sad puppy's, and said,
"I'm sorry. I'm really sorry."
"I believe you,"
said Jean-Marie thickly, not seeming to register the fact that the ninth had spoken.
"Magnus likes you. Liked. He wouldn't have let anything happen to Abigail," she added all in a rush. "She hated heights. She never would have risked falling, and she was a spirit magician. If it was ghosts, why couldn't she—"
From before them, Colum gave such a racking and explosive cough that it made both Jean-Marie and Gideon jump. His eyes rolled back in his head as he choked staccato gasps, pulling in reeking smoke, while his adept said merely,
"15 minutes. You're getting tardy."
And nothing more. Gideon would have liked Jean-Marie to finish her sentence, but Hero was limping over with an expression like trouble. She had the distant, brow-puckered frown of a woman untying gruesomely knotted shoelaces. Gideon watched the Cavalier of the Fourth walk away with hunched shoulders and a hand clasped around the grip of her rapier, and she fell into Hera's wake, a half-step behind her.
"You okay?"
"I'm sick of these people," said Hera Hark,
ducking down a passageway and away from the central atrium.
"I am sick of their slowness, sick to death. I can't wait here for one of them to grasp the implications of everything they have been told."
Gideon couldn't wait to grasp those implications either, but it didn't seem likely any time soon.
"Because we will be far ahead of them by then. We have a door to open."
"Yes, tomorrow morning after at least 8 hours sleep," Gideon suggested without hope.
"An admirable attempt at comedy in these trying times," said Harrow Hark. "Let's go."
Chapter 19. The key they had purchased so dearly from the construct gave very little away, other than its unusual colour. It was big, The shaft was as long as Gideon's middle finger, and the clover head satisfactorily heavy to hold, but it had no helpful tag saying, e.g., first floor. This did not seem to give Harrowhark pause. She whipped out her stained journal and brooded over her maps, hiding in a dark alcove and making her cavalier keep watch. Considering that there were exactly zero people around, this seemed stupid. Then again, the idea that there might not be zero people around, that there was something horrible infesting Kanan House, something that had killed Abigail and Magnus for a perceived slight. Well, Gideon did not stand there as easily as she might have yesterday. The first house was no longer a beautiful and empty shell, buffeted by the erosion of time. Now it seemed more like the blocked-up labyrinths beneath the ninth house, kept sealed in case something became restless. When she was young, she used to have nightmares about being on the wrong side of the door of the locked tomb, especially after what Harrow had done.
"Look," said Harrowhark.
No murder, sorrow, or fear could ever touch Harrow Nona Jessamus. Her tired eyes were alight. A lot of her paint had peeled away or been sweated off down in the facility, and the whole left side of her jaw was just grey-tinted skin. A hint of her humanity peeked through. She had such a peculiarly pointed little face, high-browed and tippy everywhere, and a slanted and vicious mouth. She said irascibly, "At the key, moron, not at me." The moron looked at the key, but did give her the middle finger. Hera was holding the thing upside down for inspection. At the butt end, where the teeth terminated, a tiny carving had been made in the metal. It was a collection of dots joined together with a line and two half-circles.
"It's the sign on my door," said Gideon.
"You mean X-203?
"Yeah, I mean that, if you're talking in moonspeak," said Gideon. "It's definitely the symbol on my door."
Harrow nearly trembled with eagerness. It took them a while to sneak down the curling route from the atrium to the corridor to the foyer leading to the pit. She was paranoid, and her paranoia had infected Gideon. They kept waiting before turning corners, and then stopping to hear if they were being followed. By the time they reached the airless little vestibule and had slipped the tapestry aside from the doorframe and ducked through, Gideon's stomach wanted breakfast. Nonetheless, her palms were slick with anticipation as they stood in front of the enormous black door. The animal skulls were as eerie and unwelcoming as they had been the first time, the writhing fat figure curled around each column as creepy and as cold. Harrowhark set her hands on the black stone crossbar of the door almost reverently and pressed her ear to the rock as though she could hear what was going on inside. She stroked her thumb pad over the deep-set keyhole and pulled her hood over her head.
"Unlock it," she said.
"Don't you want the honors?"
"It's your keyring," said Harrow unexpectedly, "and we will do this by the book. If teacher's correct, there is something around here that is fairly hot on etiquette, and etiquette is cheap. The keyring is yours, I have to admit it, so you must admit us."
She held out the key to Gideon.
"Put it in the hole, Griddle."
"That's what she said," said Gideon,
and she took the ring from Harrow's gloved fingers. She did not put her own hood up, but she slipped her glasses back onto her nose. Now that she'd adjusted, she really only needed them for the midday light, but they'd become something of a comfort. She drummed her fingers on the beveled frame of lightless stone, and then she slid the red response key into the lock. It fit. The lock clicked open as easily as if it had been kept oiled for the last 10,000 years. Without the slightest creak or groan of hinge, the door swung inward at a push. Gideon slipped her rapier from her belt and her knuckle knives onto her left hand, and she walked into the darkness. It was dark. She did not dare go farther into the quiet and shadowy stillness, thrown into deeper quiet by her necromancer slipping in behind and pushing the massive door shut. They stood in the room and smelled the age of it, the dust, the chemicals hanging in the air. You could almost smell the darkness. Harrow's voice, almost a whisper.
A light, Nev.
What?
You did bring a torch.
This is a service I was unaware I was meant to provide, said Gideon.
There followed soft cursing. She felt Harrow turn back toward the door, measure its width with her hands, grope blindly along the doorframe in order to find a lantern. She found something, and from the wall there came a loud click. Electric lights blared to life overhead, throwing the dark and lonely room into nice sharp relief. Gideon didn't know what she'd expected. She stood rooted to the ground, and so did Harrow. And for long moments, they just got their fill of looking. It was a study, left crystallized by someone who had one day stood up and never come back to the place where they must have worked for years. It was a long, square, spacious apartment, windowless, but beautifully lit. A long rail of electric lamps threw spotlights on important points in the room's geography. One end of the room was occupied by a laboratory. Stained, scoured laminate benches and shelves of notes in leather-bound books or ring binders. The big metal sink and the scrubbing up brush looked strange against the walls, which were inlaid with bones. A pot was still full of fat chalk sticks to draw diagrams, and the flasks of preserved blood were still full and very red. Tacked up over one bench were thick sheaves of flimsy, dark with graphs and models. One of the flimsies was a rough drawing of a familiar chimera, many-armed, armor-ribbed, squat-skulled. There were jeweled tools. There were epoxy spatulas that had been melted in some experiment. There was a blown-up picture on the wall, a lithograph or a polymer photograph, of a group of people clustered around a table. Their faces had all been scribbled out with a thick black marker pen. Harrowhark had already drifted to the laboratory. She hadn't drawn breath yet. She was going to have to, Gideon thought distantly, or she'd be out on the floor. The room had been split into three main parts. There was the laboratory, and then a broad space where the furniture had been moved out of the way for an empty stone floor. The wall had a sword rack, and the sword rack still held two lonely rapiers, gleaming as though they'd been filed and whetted an hour before. A training floor. Leant up against the wall was a hideous collection of oblong metal shapes and stocks. It took Gideon a long time to realize that she was looking at something goddamn ancient. It was a blowback carbine gun. She'd only ever seen pictures. The third part of the room was a raised platform with polished wooden stairs. The wood here was not so degraded as in the rest of Canaan House. This lightless, shut-off room must have preserved it, or otherwise somehow been stopped in time. The hairs on the back of Gideon's neck had risen when the lights came on, and they hadn't gone back down, as if her intrusion might well tempt time back to claim its grave goods. She found herself climbing the stairs and staring at a sweetly banal and domestic sight, a bookcase, a low table, a squashy armchair, and two beds. On the table was a teapot and two cups that lay abandoned forever. The two beds were close to each other. If you lay in one, you could stretch out and touch whoever was sleeping in the other, provided you had a long arm, separated only by a nightstand. Much like the grotesque cradle tacked to the end of the enormous four-poster back in Harrow's bedroom, the two people here would have been in proximity to wake if the other one sneezed. On the nightstand was another lamp and debris that people had never cleared up. A very old watch, an empty glass, a filament-fine silver bracelet with no clasp, a shallow, greasy glass dish full of grey stuff like ashes. Gideon could tell they weren't cremains, and when she touched them, a strong scent clung to her fingers. The pillows had been smoothed out on the carved wooden cots, and the beds had been made. Someone had left a pair of extremely worn slippers beneath one, a crumpled piece of flimsy next to the nightstand. Gideon picked up the latter. Harrow let out a cry of triumph. Gideon turned away from the beds and put the flimsy in her pocket, then stretched over the stair railing to see what her necromancer was delighted about. She was by the workbench, staring at two great stone tablets that had been fused to the stone, shot through with pale green filaments glowing beneath Harrow's touch. The writing was small and cramped, and the diagrams totally impenetrable in their obtuseness. Harrow was already pulling out her journal.
"It's the theorem from the trial room," she called out. "It's the completed methodology for transference, for the utilization of a living soul. It's the whole experiment."
"Is this an exciting necromancer thing?"
"Yes, Nav, it is an exciting necromancer thing. I need to copy this down. I can't lift the stone. Whoever did this was a genius."
Gideon let Harrow have at it and opened the first drawer of the nightstand. Sitting there, offensively ordinary, were three pencils, a finger bone, a coarse sharpening stone. Bones and whetstones were beginning to feed her growing suspicion about who'd lived there, and an old, worn-down seal. She stared at the seal a while. It was the crimson and white emblem of the second house. She sat down carefully on one of the beds, and the sprung mattress squeaked. She took the piece of crumpled-up flimsy out of her pocket and began trying to uncrumple it. It was part of a note that had, at some long-ago point, been ripped up, and this was just one scrunched corner.
"I'm done," said Harrow from below. "Tell me anything of import."
Gideon stuffed the piece of flimsy back into her pocket and had a quick scan through the other drawers. A lost sock, a scalpel, oilcloth, a tin with nothing in it but the vague waft of peppermints. This was all the stuff you'd find in anyone's bedside drawers, though, then again, not quite anyone's, a particular pair of people. She descended the stairs and tipped her dark glasses high on her head.
"A Cav and their necro lived here," she said.
"I drew the same conclusion," said Harrow Hark, shuffling her papers.
She put one of her diagrams close to the one inscribed on the stone tablet to compare them for accuracy.
"Here, come and take a look at this."
Harrow's cramped handwriting was just as bad as the etching on the tablet. At the very end of a long list of exquisitely boring notes was a line on its own. "In the hope of attaining literal understanding, all glory and love to the Necrolord Prime." The ninth necromancer said,
"Now there's a helpful postscript if ever I saw one."
"Yeah, and the fact that there are two beds upstairs and a bunch of swords also help," said Gideon. "They were living in each other's pockets. They studied weird literal theorems. There's a seriously old second house sign in one of the top drawers."
They both took the time to roam around the room. Harrow flipped through notebooks and narrowed her eyes over the contents. Gideon picked up another book and squinted at the faded message on the flyleaf, written in black ink forever ago and frozen in time.
"One flesh, one end, G and P."
They combed over the detritus of two strangers' lives. Inside a forgotten tin, Gideon found two expired toothbrushes. They were electronic ones with revolving heads and push buttons.
"These aren't just seriously old. They're super unbelievably seriously old," she said.
"Yes," said Harrow. "Sextus could tell us how old, but I've no desire to ask him. Something has been done to preserve this room. It is not wasted away into a natural death. We're probably the first people to step inside since its previous occupants left."
It didn't seem to be a proper bedroom. More like a place to stay overnight while doing something else. More lab than living space. Gideon ended up staring at the photolithograph, elbows pressed into the countertop, studying faceless bodies gathered primly in their chairs. A rainbow of arms and robes, low-resolution hands clasping low-resolution knees. The hands without faces seemed solemnly posed, almost anxious.
"All I know," said Hero Hark eventually, "is that they created the theorem and were responsible for the experiment downstairs. I wish I knew more. I yearn to know more. But I don't. I'm going to study this spell, Griddle, and learn it, and then I will be one step closer to knowing. We cannot suffer the same fate as Quinn and Pent."
Gideon was amazed at how badly it hurt all of a sudden. "He's really dead," she said aloud.
"Yes, I will be more upset if he suddenly changes condition," said Harrow. "He was a stranger, Nav. Why does it affect you so much?"
"He was nice to me," she found herself saying. She was very tired. She tried to wake herself up by stretching, dropping down to touch her toes and feeling the blood rush into her head. "Because he was a stranger, I think. He didn't have to bother with me, to make time for me or remember my name. But he did. Hell, you treat me more like a stranger than Magnus Quinn did, and I've known you all my life. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it."
Hera's hand, peeled and naked without a glove and stained with ink all the way up to her cuticles, appeared in front of her. Gideon found her shoulder drawn back so that she had to look Hera square in the face. The necromancer regarded her with a strangely fierce eye, mouth a worn-down line of indecision, forehead puckered as though she was thinking her entire face into a wrinkle. There was still blood flaking out of her eyebrows, which was gross.
"I must no longer accept," she said slowly, "being a stranger to you."
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," said Gideon, sudden sweat prickling the back of her neck. "Yes, you can. You once told me to dig myself an ice grave. Stop before this gets weird."
"Quinn's death proves that this is not a game," said Harrow, moistening her ashy lips with her tongue. "The trials are meant to winnow out the wheat from the chaff, and it is going to be exceptionally dangerous. We are all the sons and daughters that the House of the Ninth possesses, Nav."
"I'm not anybody's son or daughter," said Gideon firmly, now in no small panic.
"I need you to trust me."
"I need you to be trustworthy."
In the thick dimness of the room, she watched the black-garbed girl in front of her struggle around a thing that had settled over them like a net, a thing that had fused between them like a badly broken limb, shattered numerous times, healing, gnarled and awful. Gideon recognized these strictures all of a sudden, the rope tying her to Harrow and back to the bars of the House of the Ninth. They stared at each other with shared panic.
Harrow said finally, "In what way can I earn your trust?"
"Let us sleep for 8 bloody hours and never talk like this again," said Gideon, and her necromancer relaxed very minutely. Her eyes were so lightlessly black that it was hard to see the pupil. Her mouth was thin and waspish and unsure. She remembered when Harrow was 9, when she had walked in at just the wrong moment. She remembered that 9-year-old Harrow's mouth falling slightly slack. There was something curious about Harrow's face when it was not fixed into the bland church mask of the reverend daughter. Something thin and desperate and quite young about it. Something not totally removed from Jean-Marie's desperation.
8.5, Harrow said, "if we start again immediately in the morning."
"Done.
Done."
Several hours later, Gideon turned over in her bed, chilled by the realization that Harrow had not promised to never talk like that again. Too much of this shit and they'd end up friends. As they walked back, the halls were as lonely as they ever had been, emptier somehow, as though, with the fifth's untimely end, Canaan House had managed to expunge what little self it had. There was only one exception.
A quiet pattering of steps drew both of them pressed flat into an alcove, staring out at the thin, grey pre-morning light. On very nearly silent feet, the fourth teens passed before them, rapidly crossing an empty and dilapidated hall on some mission. Jean-Marie led with her rapier drawn, and her necromancer stumbled behind, head bent, blue hood over his hair, looking like a penitent. Another second, and they were gone. Gideon found herself thinking, "Poor little buggers." In her nest of blankets, the light coming in yellow and unwelcome from the cracks around the curtains, Gideon was too tired to take off her clothes, and almost too tired to sleep. She kept rustling when she turned over, trying to find a comfortable spot. And then she remembered the crinkled note in her pocket. In the dim light, she smoothed it open and stared at it, blearily, pillows still sticky with bits of the cold cream she used to take off her paint. "We all know the sad and trying reality is that this will remain incomplete t- the last. He can't fix my deficiencies. Please give Gideon my congratulations, however." Chapter 20. An inauspicious 9 hours later, Gideon and Harrow were making their way down the long, cold staples of the facility ladder, the air thick with last night's blood. Having been woken up just 35 minutes previous, Harrow always lied. Gideon climbed down into the dark with the distinct sensation that she was still asleep, somewhere in a dream she'd had a long time ago and suddenly remembered. She had mechanically downed the mug of cooling tea and the bowl of congealing porridge that Hera had brought her that morning. Hera arranging her breakfast was a concept so disagreeable there was no space left in her head for it, and now it sat leadenly in her stomach. The crumpled note lay hastily interred at the very bottom of Gideon's pocket. Everything felt dark and strange and incorrect, right down to the still-drying paint her adept had applied to her face. Gideon had not even murmured dissent at this incursion.